Hi, I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with John Cassidy, president and CEO at King & Union, headquartered in Alexandria, Virginia, and recognized as one of the hottest and most innovative cybersecurity companies by numerous media outlets. To learn more about King & Union, visit kingandunion.com. John, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, we're here to talk about the world's first CISO. Little backdrop, the Chief Information Security Officer role dates back to 1994 when Citigroup, which was then Citicorp, set up a specialized cybersecurity office after suffering a series of cyber attacks from Russian hackers, which cost the bank $10 million. Their CISO at the time was Steve Katz, and he spent 6 years in that role. You had a chance to watch a video of Steve telling his story. What was your initial impression?
Well, first of all, I guess I didn't really know that the first CISO dated back to 1994. And I think that I really enjoyed Steve's perspective and coming on in that capacity for the bank and enjoyed listening to sort of what he was faced with in his early days when he was started out. And I guess especially when he had to deal with a hack and then that was made public and then sort of the impact to him and his team. So it was really a really good piece.
So after watching Steve, do you see similarities between the cyber threats and adversaries faced by large enterprises 25 years ago and what they're up against today? For instance, social engineering, which he had to deal with back then?
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely similarities. I think, you know, after watching the presentation by Steve on the video, I think that there's similarities between that there's always nefarious actors wanting to do bad things to financials and other different infrastructures. What struck me was I was in information security 25 years ago at an early stage internet company, really at the beginning of when AOL and dial-up modems and that whole industry around the internet was starting to really blossom and get going. I actually was trained in 1995 on a firewall system that many years ago. And I can tell you that, yes, there were definitely bad actors, but the size, complexity, and scale of what people are facing today really, really dwarfs what was happening in 1994 and 1995. And I really look at that in a big part due to the advance of the internet and getting the internet into the hands of millions and millions of people. And then through that surface area growing, the attacks, the sophistication of those attacks and the number of people that could access the network to have impacts against banks and others exponentially grew. I think some other things that actually were added to was the advent of cloud computing along the last 25 years. Mobile devices were present in 1995, but now every single person and employee and companies have them, which, you know, increased the risk to your organization. But I think there's a lot of similarities. I think that just the complexity of some of the attackers and the size and scale of those attacks, especially from nation states, have grown significantly.
So, John, you and your company have a lot of experience in the financial services industry. That was the target of choice by cyber criminals in the mid-90s, and that doesn't seem to have changed much, although they've certainly diversified into healthcare and other industries. What are your thoughts? Are you still seeing banks and financial services providers as a primary target?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, my early work when I got into cybersecurity was really focused on helping out the government and critical infrastructure companies, which did include the banking infrastructure. Financial services and banks and brokers and others are absolutely a prime key target for attackers, and they always will be. I think what we've seen is that over time, you know, even dating back to some of the messages that Steve had talked about, it goes back to the capability of being able to defend yourself. And the level of sophistication of the attackers increased over the last 25 years, but also did the capabilities of the banks and financial institutions to combat and thwart those attacks. So you have, you know, this chicken and egg thing going on where the banks are playing catch up to the attackers, and they always will. When my work with the government was going on, we had some of the most sophisticated capabilities, you know, in the planet and across the globe, and we were still trying to change constantly with the tactics, techniques, and procedures of the attackers. And what's happened over time is these bad guys and bad actors that are out there are really going for the unlocked car door. They're not going for the Tesla where you can't find the door handles. They're going for the people that are leaving the doors open and the keys in the car, and they're finding ways in from people that don't have the budgets and expertise, such as state, local governments, education, which we're seeing with some of the attacks that are happening as the, you know, some of the kids and everything go back to school with remote workers, the retail industry. So now that, you know, the financials will always be a target, but now the bad guys are going after other ways to also benefit from their efforts.
So you touch on budgets. Steve Katz says he had a blank check for information security when he started at Citicorp. Of course, you know, that was a unique situation. By 2015, just a few years ago, Citigroup's annual IT security budget had swelled to more than $300 million. Is this what cybercrime has come to, John? A large financial institution needs to spend hundreds of millions of dollars every year in order to protect themselves and their clients from cybercrime?
Well, I think what I've seen over, you know, being in this space for a long time is that the money and resources being spent by organizations has dramatically increased. And what I've seen is actually people, and maybe it's tied to some of the issues that we're dealing with the pandemic, people are looking for where they can contain costs and spend. And I think that, you know, one example would be around the realm of threat intelligence. So many years ago, I met with CISOs of a large oil and gas company, and they brought to my attention, because I was living in this threat intelligence space, and they said, John, I'm spending tens of, you know, $20 million on threat intelligence, and I want to find out how to bring more value out of that data. So they were spending the money, but they were looking for where the value proposition was. And I think what we're starting to see is rather than, you know, throwing money at the problem, it's being able to throw that money at the problem, but in a much more targeted and aligned way with the problem. And the other thing that I would say to the companies that are spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, this is because companies are doing it on their own. So major banks that I've worked with, very capable, some of the most sophisticated companies and organizations in the world, but they're spending hundreds, like you're saying, $300 million, and the bank right down the street is spending the same amount of money. There's a way that if people actually get to true collaboration and are willing through an anonymized way to work together and share information and learn from each other and pass that intelligence and knowledge downhill to more people, then I can see overall cost containment, you know, being realized by the industry.
So that's a really important point, John. Maybe you can expand on it, because if you look at the collective spending by, say, just the four largest banks, you take JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, you're talking about $1.5 billion being spent annually on cybersecurity. I mean, that's a number that would constitute an industry all by itself. Yet, we're still seeing hacks and breaches. So how do they come together to, you know, improve security as a group?
Yeah, I think there's wonderful things being done with the FSISAC and getting, you know, the 7,000 member organizations together. There's even a group of these largest banks that we're talking about, the JP Morgans and Bank of America, Wells Fargo and others, that actually started a consortium called the FSARC, where it's, you know, 20 or so of the largest financials in the United States coming together in a more focused initiative to figure out how we can do this better together. And I think that's essential. The things that are being learned by the Wells Fargos are very critical to Bank of America, and being able to have trust across your peers in that industry will only protect, you know, the mass of banks and even the smaller and regional banks if it's passed down through the FSISAC in a much bigger way. But I think it's finding new ways to increase flexibility to get to analysis of data, finding more effective ways to buy the data that's necessary. So you can use open source intelligence. The banks are doing things within their own internal infrastructures to create intelligence. But it's really, what is that higher level intelligence that can be shared across all the banking infrastructure in a timely fashion, rather than using traditional methods that are still existing today, which are spreadsheets, which are emails, which are, you know, tens of 20s of, you know, hundreds of Slack channels in some cases. So I think that some of those things would help to, you know, be able to reduce the spend, but also provide greater benefits to, you know, banks and in other industries by working together.
So I want to pivot here and talk a little bit about the labor crunch. That was a topic we covered with Steve, and it was a problem back then. It's a much bigger problem now. He mentioned several CISOs who he knows, including Jason Witte, who's the CISO at JP Morgan Chase. We filmed an interview with Jason a couple of years ago when he was the CISO at US Bank Corp. And he told us one of the biggest problems all CISOs have is a shortage of talent. And he, you know, stands by that today. Cybersecurity Ventures predicts there will be 3.5 million unfilled cybersecurity jobs by 2021, next year. That's up from 1 million positions in 2014. We're moving in the wrong direction. The numbers are continuing to go up. What are you hearing from the large enterprise CISOs who you speak to?
I mean, I can tell you that my conversations with CISOs across the board, whether it's within the federal government, across banks, other industries, they're all faced with this problem with job in positions that they can't fill. I think the biggest problem that I hear that, and I look at the numbers that you shared, and I remember when that number was 300,000. And so you can see that it's just growing and growing. And it's really, you know, it comes down to that the problem really hasn't been solved. People are throwing money at the problem. But I think that some of this is around technology, and there's wonderful companies, you know, including our own, that are trying to take stabs at how we actually reduce the amount of human engagement. But it's very important to keep in mind that there's so many unfilled cybersecurity jobs because you need the human talent. So I think that everybody's looking at this like a machine can fix this problem. And, you know, I think that it can for a portion of it, but the human element of cybersecurity is critical. And that's kind of why I go back to my point of, you need to have humans collaborating. We'll never have enough humans to go around that have this skill set, because, you know, there's other people doing other things besides cybersecurity. So I think it's really figuring out a way to benefit from the good things being done at organizations and sharing and collaborating and working together that is going to help make a dent in this unfilled cybersecurity jobs. The other thing is the retention problem. I can tell you that, you know, in my experience, one of the key problems was we would bring in young analysts and we would train them in my former position, and we would get them top secret security clearances, and they would be gone within a year, and they would leave the things that we were working on that were so critical because they were trained, and they could get a job down the road for a 20% pay raise. So that's why you see a lot of turnover and retention in this business. So I think, you know, for the CISOs I talk to, it's keeping the work interesting for your staff, keeping them engaged in something that's not just clearing alerts, getting them engaged in real work. And that's sort of what we've tried to do with our platform, is kind of help reduce a lot of the noise, let machines do that work. But the part that actually does the analysis and intelligence, let the humans do what they do best and work with their peers and colleagues to get the job done.
So let's take what you just shared, which is really important. And I think you hit the nail on the head about, you know, the problem we have with the turnover, with the retention. And you're talking about the CISOs who have to deal with that. Now let's elevate that to the board and to C-suite executives, because they're faced with the same challenge at the CISO level. We recently conducted a study, and this took us months. It was a very, very thorough study. We did a roll call going straight through the entire Fortune 500, all 500 companies. And what we learned is that nearly 25% of CISOs have been in their position for just a year. Musical chairs, a lot of turnover. Steve says this has a lot to do with stress. The idea is that CISOs will get thrown under the bus when their company suffers a cyber attack. You know, what's going on? Because, you know, if we don't have stability in the CISO ranks, how are they going to, you know, then deal with the, you know, rank and file underneath them?
And that's a great topic. And, you know, it goes back to even Steve Katz and what he was saying about, you know, the stress. And it's interesting, if you look back when Steve took the first role in 1994 back for the bank, it was like he was the first CISO, right? So you've got 25 years between that time and now. And I would say probably outside of the largest banks, even within the federal government, it wasn't until about 10 years ago that you started to see the CISO position starting to become more prominent. And I think that the adoption from the financial industry is very close with what the government does from the sophisticated analysis side in the IC. And you can see that the financial institutions were probably the first to put the CISOs in place, and it started to trickle down. So now you've got healthcare organizations, you know, friends of mine that are now the CISOs in health systems. You have retail organizations that now have CISOs. You have some large law firms that have CISOs. So I think this is a compounded problem, that not only is the stress increasing at an exponential rate because of they're faced with sometimes budget shortfalls. Not everybody's as lucky as Steve Katz to have an unlimited budget, but you have budget problems to deal with. You have retention and layover. So you have huge stresses, but then also, just like I talked about with other security positions, you have many open positions and people trying to hire for CISOs, and they're willing to pay some top dollar for that expertise. So I think that also is a contributing factor.
So a little earlier, you touched on FSISAC. For people who aren't familiar, that's the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center, a collaboration between the financial services industry, banks and providers. Steve Katz was the first chair and founder, and he calls that an honor. Today, Jason Witte is the chairman. How important is FSISAC to the financial services community, John?
I mean, I would say it's extremely critical. In my former role, I was working with the government early on, sort of during the years of the formations of the ISACs that happened really after 9/11. Figuring out how to share information better across industries. And the financial services ISAC has been, I'd say a model for really how to get this sharing and collaboration going in information security. They've continued to grow. They've continued to bring new capabilities. They have very close, tight partnerships with a wide variety of cutting edge vendors that work with them to support the mission of their 7,000 members. So I think it's absolutely essential. The other thing that I think that some people don't realize is the importance of the FSISAC to the other ISACs. So many of the other ISACs, like the IT ISAC, Energy ISAC, ONG, you name it, really have a close relationship, and that may be through the National Council of ISACs, but they have great relationships between themselves and the FSISAC, because the FSISAC is wonderful to help share some of the best practices and things that they're doing for the betterment of the rest of the ISACs, which also in turn help to protect, U.S. critical infrastructure in a big way. So it's a very critical organization.
So, John, the FSISAC recently issued guidance to all of its members, 7,000, as you point out, encouraging them to double down on cybersecurity as the COVID-19 pandemic has sent millions of employees to work from home. What would you say is the most important recommendation?
I was thinking about this, and I mean, number one, in talking to friends that run organizations, internal security teams, is follow the guidelines that are being shared from your security teams. You only log into certain Wi-Fi, you use the VPN they tell you to, you don't click on certain spear phishing links that you've been trained, follow the training that's shared by your organization. So it's critical to always You might think you're safe working from home, but I can tell you from real life experience and people I talk to that you're much more at risk when you're working from home. And that risk then also is a risk for your corporation or your entity or organization you're working with. And I think the other thing is to make sure that you collaborate even more with your company and leveraging your teams within your company. So an example would be one of our large Fortune 5 companies. They have a group of cyber threat intelligence team members, and they're all working from home. But you know, using our platform, we've been able to help them work much more focused together and taking them out of Excel spreadsheets and Slack and others and using email for exchange of information and actually using a platform to communicate in a much more effective way when doing cyber analysis. And that's a benefit to the overall company because now they're actually working with other groups like the forensics teams and the malware groups. So really look at ways that you can break down some of the silos that exist in your organization because, you know, working from home has only really created and emphasized those silos existing. So I would say continue to try to find ways that you can stay engaged with your company in new ways.
So, John, we've been talking mainly about financial services simply because that's where the world's first CISO comes from. And while that industry remains under constant cyber attack, the same is true for healthcare, manufacturing, other industries. What are you hearing from these other markets?
I mean, I would say that the impact in financial services is constant and it's happening all the time and it always will. The attacks, and we kind of talked about it at one of the beginning questions, the attack surface has grown and with the different attackers that are looking for different ways in, they're finding those vulnerable areas to break into. So in my background, like I shared before, was supporting the US government and critical infrastructure companies. And we were trying to find ways that we could actually have the government help support some of these companies. And this included every single sector from defense contractors, wastewater treatment facilities that people don't even consider as a target, dam infrastructure. So you can imagine the IoT concern. Mm. So there's many things that go beyond, you know, the financial and banking industry is obviously a target because it's money and they're trying to go after that. But some of the things like with ransomware, destructive attacks, like we talked about just a minute ago with dams, energy attacks, very, very critical. And I'm, you know, hearing that even during the pandemic that the attacks that are happening that I'm being told about are increasing at an exponential rate compared to pre-pandemic.
So looking ahead, John, to 2021, is there one big picture trend or focal issue that you predict CISOs will be addressing? Or do you see them continuing to grapple with these same issues that have been plaguing them for the past 25 years?
Well, I mean, I think one of the big shifts in the industry, which is moving to faster adoption, it was sort of happening with cloud-based, you know, enterprise adoption for your systems. But this pandemic has expedited that. So I think you're seeing in the market showing that the increase in cloud security is absolutely becoming more essential. I think the remote working and your ability to really be distanced from your employees. You don't have people in a SOC working together as much anymore. A lot of them are remote. So being able to have tools and processes and procedures that help people collaborate and be able to access different data in different ways very quickly, especially in like a security analysis type role, are essential. But I think a lot of the problems that they've been facing as a CISO before continue to persist, but now you have a couple extra problems. So, you know, hopefully the CISO's stress level doesn't get too high and they leave like we talked about.
Right. Well, John, I've heard, you know, such great things about you and your company and just recently had a chance to speak with you for the first time. So it was really great to have you on today. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope we could do this again.
Thank you very much.
I'm Steve Morgan, founder of Cybersecurity Ventures and editor-in-chief at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining us today was John Cassidy, President and CEO at King & Union, headquartered in Alexandria, Virginia, and recognized as one of the hottest and most innovative cybersecurity companies by numerous media outlets. To learn more about our sponsor, King & Union, visit kingandunion.com. You can listen to all of our podcasts at cybercrime.radio.